From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Memories of a Rock and Roll Survivor, we talk with Al Cooper, who has updated his memoir, Backstage Passes and Backstabbing Bastards. Cooper was a member of the Blues Project and a founder of Blood, Sweat, and Tears. He played the now famous organ line on Dylan's Like a Rolling Stone, and he started his career when he was 13, playing guitar with the Royal Teens, which had the hit Short Shorts. Also today, Daniel Drennan's New York Diaries, True Tales of Urban Trauma. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stasio. The White House has begun its defense of the president before the House Judiciary Committee. The panel is scheduled to begin debate on articles of impeachment later this week. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
The president's defense includes three basic themes: that independent counsel Kenneth Starr failed to make a compelling case of impeachable conduct by the president, that even if Starr's charges are proven, they don't rise to the level of an impeachable offense. The third point, delivered by special counsel Greg Craig, was to convey the president's profound and powerful regret for what he's done.
The president wants everyone to know, the committee, the Congress, and the country, that he is genuinely sorry for the pain and the damage that he has caused and for the wrongs that he has committed.
But Craig went on to say that there's a difference between immoral acts and illegal conduct. Under questioning from Republicans, Craig said in the areas where the president's testimony differs from Monica Lewinsky's, the White House believes Lewinsky's statements were erroneous. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, the Capitol.
New clashes erupted today between Israelis and Palestinians in the West Bank. In three incidents on the West Bank, Palestinians threw stones at Israeli troops and civilians. The soldiers fired rubber-coated bullets. At least five people were hurt. The problems are flaring just 5 days before President Clinton's visit to the region. The trip is intended to shore up the Wye River Agreement and restore calm. In Nigeria, several U.S.-based international monitors are describing as orderly and peaceful the country's first democratic election since 1993. But the monitors say there are some problems that need addressing before presidential voting in 2 months. Among the monitors are officials from the Atlanta-based Carter Center. NPR Charlene Hunter-Galt reports.
Observers said that a serious shortcoming of Nigeria's election was a failure to guarantee secrecy of the ballot. Polling booths were open, and often voters marked their ballots in full view of others. During a press conference in the Nigerian capital, Abuja, the observers also said that many potential voters were disenfranchised, either because of problems with unfamiliar registration procedures and poorly trained polling staff, or because the two-week period was not enough to try and sign up some 60 million voters. The observation team recommended an additional registration period as well as more government funds for the cash-strapped Independent National Election Commission. I'm Charlene Hunter-Galt, NPR News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Iraq warned today that UN arms inspectors would not be allowed to work in Iraq indefinitely if economic sanctions against the country are not lifted. Deputy Premier Tariq Aziz made the announcement as arms experts prepared today to resume surprise inspections. A widespread power outage hit the San Francisco area this morning, cutting service to thousands of electric customers and snarling traffic at the height of rush hour. Pacific Gas and Electric said it appears power was out to 36,000 customers in and around San Francisco. A spokesman said the company is still investigating the cause of the outage. You're listening to NPR News. In NPR's business update, after starting the week on an up note, stocks have cooled somewhat today, though at least one sector of the market is not apparently ready to give up yet. NPR's Jack Speer reports.
While blue-chip stocks started lower after the open this morning on the high-technology-dominated NASDAQ stock market, it's a different story today. The NASDAQ, after closing yesterday at a record high of 2040, is up again today. Analysts say the rise in the NASDAQ comes as technology companies continue to draw interest and investors look for places to put their money as the year winds down. In fact, for the year, the NASDAQ is now up 30%. Stock in AT&T, meanwhile, rose today following the announcement the company will buy IBM's networking business for $5 billion. Stock in GE, however, was lower after Gary Wendt confirmed he will resign as head of the company's highly profitable GE Capital Corp. Wendt, who has had a somewhat stormy relationship with GE Chairman Jack Welch, has resigned effective December 31st. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Nissan Motor Company reportedly plans to cut 500 jobs in the U.S. by the year 2000. It's part of a restructuring of its North American operations. A Japanese newspaper says Nissan will merge its two California-based units, Nissan North America and Nissan Motor Corporation. The report says Nissan hopes the effort, coupled with new promotions, will help American operations return to profitability. Federal regulators are reportedly looking into whether the hedge fund Long-Term Capital Management misled potential investors before its near collapse. The Wall Street Journal says the Securities and Exchange Commission is probing whether officials with the hedge fund properly disclosed the troubles it was facing. Federal Reserve officials subsequently helped arrange a $3.5 billion bailout. I'm Frank Stacio, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music in more than 200 neighborhoods across the United States, where browsing is a fine art. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Al Cooper, has revised and expanded his memoir, Backstage Passes and Backstabbing Bastards, and it's filled with interesting behind-the-scenes stories about pop and rock from the 50s to the 90s. Cooper played in the Blues Project, then founded Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and wrote most of their early songs. He played on Dylan's albums Blonde on Blonde and Highway 61 Revisited, and played the famous organ line on Dylan's Like a Rolling Stone. He's also played on recordings by the Rolling Stones, Jimi Hendrix, and George Harrison, and produced records by Lynyrd Skynyrd, Nils Lofgren, and Rick Nelson. He's now teaching at the Berklee School of Music. He started his career when he was still a teenager. At the age of 14, he became the guitar player in the Royal Teens after they had their hit Short Shorts. And through his new connections, he started writing songs for pop performers, working out of one of the New York buildings on Broadway that headquartered many of the pop writers of the 50s and early 60s. Al Cooper told me how he started getting his songs placed at such a young age.
Well, I met a couple of publishers that were really interested in having as much material to peddle as they could, and they signed me at an early age. I had to actually have my parents' signature in order to be with them. And these were the sort of people that were in 1650 Broadway, and people that were, you know, anxious to gather up as much as possible and then sort of, you know, use a talent colander to find if there was anything good in all these people that they signed.
Your big pop success as a songwriter was This Diamond Ring, which was recorded by Gary Lewis and the Playboys, Gary being Jerry Lewis's son. And you say in your memoir that you wrote that song with an R&B group like the Drifters in mind. So how did it end up being performed by Gary Lewis instead of the Drifters?
Boy, it beats the hell out of me. I was amazed. My publisher at the time, Aaron Schroeder, saw me in the hallway, and he said, well, we got a record on that Drifter song you wrote. I said, oh, the Drifters cut it? He said, no. Snuff Garrett cut it. Snuff Garrett was a West Coast producer known for producing Bobby V and people like that. And I said, since when is Snuff Garrett cutting R&B records? He said, well, he's not. I said, oh, dear. He said, well, I have the record. Do you want to come upstairs and hear it? I said, well, just out of curiosity, I'd like to hear what Snuff Garrett did with This Diamond Ring. And so I went upstairs and he played the record, and I was just heartsick. I thought it was terrible. I admonished him after he played the record and said, you know, I don't even waste my time playing me things like this again. That's the worst thing I ever heard.
Of course, it became a huge hit.
Yeah, 2 months later, it was number one in the country. And I say, hey, I wrote that song.
Now, what do you think about the arrangement now?
Oh, I still hate it. I still think it's an insipid, horrible record. And as a matter of fact, I went in later years and at much expense to my credibility, recorded the song on one of my solo albums to show people where it came from and what it was like, because I actually think it's a good song. I just couldn't stand the Gary Lewis interpretation.
Okay, we're going to hear both of those versions back to back. We're going to hear the Gary Lewis version and then the version that you cut with the arrangement that you originally had in mind, the version you cut in the 1970s. So here
you know,
we go.
It's even, yeah. It's even funnier if you play it the other way around. If you play mine first and then play Gary Lewis's, which is, you know, the way I saw it, it's even funnier that way.
I'm willing to give that a shot. Is our engineer ready to do that? Our engineer's ready to do that. Let's go. So this is Al Kooper, followed by Gary Lewis's version of Al Kooper's song, This Diamond Ring.
This diamond ring don't shine for me anymore. This diamond ring don't mean what it did before. So if you've got some buddy whose love is true, won't you let it shine for you now?
Okay, Al Kooper, guess what? I like the Gary Lewis version. I'm not saying I don't like yours, but I like the Gary Lewis version. I think it's a fun pop hit.
Well, so did many millions of people.
Is the interview over now?
It's a sad thing.
No, but it's pop. I mean, it's you know, it's got a...
It's happy. You can do the math to it. It's, you know...
you don't like that kind of, like, kettle drum or whatever is on there?
Timpani, no. Timpani, it's great in, you know, certain things. It was great in the 1812 Overture.
So what did the Gary Lewis version do for your career? Did it help it a lot?
Yeah, it helped it tremendously as a songwriter. Right after that, we had another top 20 record by Gene Pitney called I Must Be Seeing Things. And
want to sing a few bars of that to refresh our memory?
Well, I'll recite the opening lyrics. I used to write the music, and I wrote with two other guys, and they wrote the words, as I was sort of lyrically deficient at the time, and actually lyrically challenged at the time. And this one, typical of its time, said, "Isn't that my girl? And is that my best friend? Aren't they walking much too close together? And it don't look like they're talking about the weather." And then it goes, you know, "Hey, I must be seeing things. This can't be." Like that. That was typical of those songs we wrote at that time.
Well, during this period, you had a lot of musical identities. You were trying to do demos for people. You were writing songs. You would occasionally perform with Paul Simon, the still unknown Paul Simon. You occasionally played at a folk club. You played in rock and roll bands. Which version of you did you want to win out?
I didn't care. I just wanted to, you know, succeed in the music business. That was my goal. I didn't know where and when it was going to happen, and I figured that if you were every place at every time, that you would have more of a chance. I had a way of thinking, as I look back at it, that at that time I was 90% ambition and 10% talent, and now, as I sit here, it's completely reversed. Now I know all this stuff, but I can't be bothered to leave the house.
Why not?
I just can't be bothered. I have no ambition anymore.
Huh. If you're just joining us, my guest is Al Kooper, and he has a new expanded version of his memoir called Backstage Passes and Backstabbing Bastards. Well, in the 1960s, you met Bob Dylan through Dylan's record producer of the time, Tom Wilson, and this was in what year, about?
1965.
And Tom Wilson had just cut Dylan's first electric single, Subterranean Homesick Blues. And he invited you to watch Dylan at a session. And you were determined, you say, to do more than watch. You wanted to actually play on it. The session turned out to be the session for Highway 61 Revisited, in which Like a Rolling Stone was recorded. And you played Hammond B3 on Like a Rolling Stone. How did you get to play on it?
Well, I was just determined to play. I was a guitar player at the time, and I stayed up all night practicing, and had an inflated opinion of my ability as a guitar player. And I got to the session, and at the time I was playing guitar on records as a session musician. So the other musicians that were there early when I got there did not think it was unusual for me to be there with my guitar, because I'd played sessions with them, and they knew that I did session work. And I set up my stuff, and I sat down, and I waited, and Dylan came in with a guitar player who was roughly my age, and he sat down and started warming up, and I realized I was in way over my head. He was the best guitar player I'd ever heard in my life, just warming up. Just the things he was playing were way beyond my grasp as a player. And I said to myself, I got to get out of here before I really embarrass myself. So when there was a moment, I took my guitar and put it in the case and put it against the wall, and I went in the control room where I belonged and watched the session. And Tom Wilson came in, and he hadn't seen me sitting out there with the guitar, so that was very good. And then during the session, they had someone playing the organ, and they moved him over to a piano. Actually, his name was Paul Griffin. He was a studio keyboard player. And I walked over to Tom Wilson. I said, "Hey, why don't you let me play organ on this? I got a great part for this." He went, "Oh, man, you're not a organ player. You're a guitar player. You don't play the organ." And I said, "Oh, yeah, I got a great part for this, Tom." And at that point, they called him for a phone call. And I thought to myself, well, he didn't say no. He just said I wasn't an organ player. And so I went out and sat down at the organ. And as a matter of fact, if Paul Griffin hadn't have left the organ switched on, that would have been the end of my career, because it's very complicated to turn on a Hammond B3 organ. It takes about 3 separate moves. And you have to know what you're doing. And I didn't. But it was on already, so I was saved. And then Tom Wilson came back out, and he said, "Okay, this is take 6. And then he saw me, and he said, "Hey, what are you doing out there?" And I just started laughing. And he was a gentleman. He just said, okay, let's go. We're rolling. This is take 7. I guess he thought, if I wanted to do this so bad, he would stand behind it, because he was my friend.
When you had told Tom Wilson that you had a part worked out in your head, did you really?
No, of course not. 90% ambition.
Okay, so then what happened? They start performing the song?
Well, they were rehearsing for a second, and I kind of got the thing. The speaker to the organ was very far from where I was sitting at the organ, and it was covered by baffling so that it wouldn't leak into other microphones that were on in the studio. And so I couldn't actually hear what I was playing. And if I put the headphones on, I could kind of hear a little bit of it, but hear the other things that were much louder, like the guitar. And I didn't have any music to read. I had to do it by ear, which I was used to doing because of playing on sessions as a guitar player. And I just kind of, muddled my way through it, and it was the only complete take of the day. So they went in to play it back and listen to it. And during the playback, Dylan went over to Tom Wilson and said, "Hey, turn the organ up." And he said, "Oh, man, that guy's not an organ player." He says, "I don't care, turn the organ up." And that's how I became an organ player.
Well, let's hear Like a Rolling Stone with my guest Al Cooper featured on organ.
Once upon a time you dressed so fine, threw the bumps of dime in your prime. Then you say beware, doll, you're bound to fall. You thought they were all kidding you. You used to laugh about everybody that was hanging out. Now you don't talk so loud. Now you don't seem so proud about having to be scrounging your next meal. How does it feel? How does it feel to be without a home? Like a complete unknown, like a rock.
My guest, Al Kooper, featured on organ. Al Kooper, are you surprised at the impact that organ line had on pop music?
Well, I mean, it was ironically hilarious because here's a guy that really didn't know what he was doing, playing Hunt and Peck organ, and like a whole style of organ playing came out of that. It founded like a whole style of organ playing, which, as we sit here, was really based on ignorance. But that's what's so great about rock. That's what makes rock and roll so great, is something like that could happen.
My guest is musician, producer, and songwriter Al Kooper. He's just expanded his memoir. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, musician, songwriter, and singer Al Kooper is my guest, and he has a new expanded version of his memoir, Backstage Passes and Backstabbing Bastards. Now, in your memoir, you write that you used to take records that were people, like bands copying what they heard on Dylan records and play them for Dylan, and that would be really amusing. So I brought in one for you to hear. I don't know if you know this one or not, but this is one that I think is really so inspired by like a Rolling Stone and has a, I don't know, an a kind of cheesy organ or electric piano, I'm not sure which it is, that seems to be inspired by your part. So let me play it for you and see what you think.
Since this is your public execution, I think I'm gonna go right on ahead. Mailman brought your letter, babe, where you told me how you feel and about the things he said he told you, and that is I'm such a heel. Well, I could never be honest that to you I'd always lied, but he saw me take some other hide for a two-wheel.
Okay, that was a song.
Don't tell me what it was, because I'm going to tell you what it
was.
Oh,
good. Okay. Go ahead.
That was Mouse in the Traps with a Public Execution.
Correct. And it's one of the records on that great anthology, Nuggets. A little Woolly Bully action in there, too, I think.
Well, yeah, it is, by the way, a very cheesy organ, probably a uh-huh. Farfisa.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah, that was one of the records that we laughed at back then.
So you played that for Dylan when it came out?
Well, as we both used to listen to them, it wasn't, you know, I'd go to the record store and then we'd go back to his house and we'd put all these records on and just sit there and laugh.
Now, this the record that you first made with Dylan got you started in a longer relationship with him, you know, playing with him, and you played with him at the Newport Festival, his first, you know, like electric concert. And it's a concert that's famous because Dylan got booed. And in your memoir, you kind of have a different interpretation of why he was getting booed. The standard interpretation is because he had electric instruments, the audience was really angry and thought that he'd sold out, etc., and they were booing him. What's your explanation?
Well, many people came to that festival, which was a three-day festival, like Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, to see Dylan because he was like the king of folk music at the time, and he was the headliner of the festival and was playing the final set on Sunday night. And so primarily a college-age crowd came, and they sat through many musics over the three-day period under the umbrella of folk music that I'm sure that they didn't care for. And most people played 45-minute to an hour sets. And then we came out and we played for 15 minutes, three electric songs. And I think that the people were horrified and incensed that we only played for 15 minutes.
But weren't they booing during the performance too, though?
No.
No?
You find me some oral record of that and I'll be very surprised. There was an undercurrent of the festival directors that were very upset with Dylan playing electric. That is a fact, and that is true. But that really had no way of making itself known to the audience that was attending the thing, other than through the press later on after the festival was over, which is how that myth came to be promulgated. After the festival, that's what the press wrote about, because they were privy to the fact that Pete Seeger and Alan Lomax were very upset with the electrification that Dylan was doing. And in fact, there were other acts that played electric at that festival that nobody got bent out of shape about, like the Chambers Brothers and the Paul Butterfield Blues Band. And they didn't get booed because they played electric.
Al Cooper, he's expanded his rock and roll memoir, Backstage Passes and Backstabbing Bastards. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Al Cooper on his work with Blood, Sweat, and Tears. He was a founding member. Then furniture flying out the window. It must be New York. Daniel Drennan reads from his New York diaries.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Al Cooper, who's just updated his memoir about his 40 years in rock and roll. We'll pick things up with the Blues Project, the band he joined in the mid-60s. Their recording, No Time Like the Right Time, is featured on the new Expanded Nuggets anthology.
Change the rain cloud into flowers. And I can see that you're afraid. You think it's some kind of mistake that you made. Well, let me set your heart at ease. 'Cause I'm down on my bended knees. Say it to you. There's no time like the right time. Baby, the right time is now.
Tom Wilson, the producer who produced Dylan's Highway 61 Revisited, later asked you to play in a band called The Blues Project. You say that there's a lot of tension in the band between, you who really wanted the band to head in a more of a rock direction and Danny Kalb, who wanted it to head in a more of a blues direction.
That's true. That was one of the balances in the band was there was a very delicate balance in the band that kept it alive, and if it was ever upset in any way, shape, or form, it could easily topple. And in later years, when we would do reunions and play, get back together again, we had to still maintain that balance, otherwise the band wouldn't work. And it was a weird thing.
From the Blues Project, you moved on to co-founding Blood, Sweat, and Tears. What's the sound you wanted from that band?
Well, I had written a group of songs that, to me, sounded like they would sound best with horns in them. And I brought that idea to the Blues Project, and they said that they didn't want to add horns. So basically, I left the band and went to put together a band that would have horns and that I could perform these songs with.
Why'd you want the horns so much?
The songs just kind of dictated that they have horns in them. I don't know what it was. It was, sort of magic in a way.
Is there a song you want to play that captures the way you wanted to use horns?
Let me think.
Without Her, maybe?
Oh, no. That was an adjunct. It really didn't. That didn't best describe the band. I would say probably I Can't Quit Her or I Love You More Than You'll Ever Know. Either one of those.
Okay.
Or My Days Are Numbered.
Why don't we hear I Love You More Than You'll Ever Know, and we'll start this a little deep into it where the horns start to become prominent. This is Blood, Sweat, and Tears. My guest is Al Cooper.
When I wasn't making too much money, where my paycheck went. You know I brought it home to baby, and I never spent one red cent. Is that a way for a man to carry on? You think it won't, his little loved one gone. I love you, more than you'll ever know, more than you'll ever know. Say, it's all right.
But I could be everything that you demand. I could be president of General Motors, baby. Or just a tiny little grain of sand. Set in a way for a man to carry on. You think he wants his little loved one gone. I love you, baby. I love you, baby. I love you more than you'll ever know.
Cooper, had you worked with horns like this before?
There was a period in my life where I wrote ghost arrangements, and I wrote for horns in that situation. But I had not really been in a band with a horn section, no. I had admired Maynard Ferguson's jazz group, which had a large horn section, and that was sort of my model for Blood, Sweat, and Tears.
I think Blood, Sweat, and Tears was pretty influential in inspiring other bands to bring horns in and to kind of incorporate something of a jazz sound.
Yeah. I think it was probably Chicago and BS&T that were equa influential. They were both germinating at the same time. It's just that the Blood, Sweat, and Tears record came out first, but Chicago was also working in the same time period that we were.
My guest is Al Cooper. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Al Cooper. He's revised and expanded his memoir. Cooper founded Blood, Sweat, and Tears and wrote most of their early songs. Now, after a while, David Clayton Thomas was brought in to replace you as the lead singer. What's the story behind that?
If I tell you, there'll be seven other people that will tell you seven different stories of what happened. So I just have to say that, because I've found in my life that that's what happens. Steve Katz would tell you a completely different story than this, and Bobby Columbia would tell you a completely different story than Steve Katz and myself, and we were all there at the same time.
What's your story?
So, my story is that unlike the Blues Project, where we did everything together, if we weren't playing or on the road and we were back home in Greenwich Village where we lived, we would go to the movies together. We would go out to eat together. We even had one rock group therapy session together in a bid to save the band. And so when Blood, Sweat, and Tears was formed, I decided that really hadn't worked very well in the Blues Project to spend so much time with everybody. And I did the opposite of that, and I was just getting married at the time, and so I would go to rehearsals and concerts and play with the band, and then I would go home and spend the time with my wife. But what happened was the other people were all hanging out together like bands do, and there was a faction that was conspiring against me in my direction that the band would go in, and in fact, me singing lead and stuff like that. And it finally came to a head, and I was just sort of forced into leaving the band, and I did. And they auditioned several people. As a matter of fact, Laura Nero was, a possibility of being the lead singer with the band. And a blind blues singer named Bobby Doyle, they also were considering. But David Clayton Thomas got the job. He was an R&B singer from Canada. And he replaced me as the singer. And the trombone player when I was in the band, Dick Halligan, replaced me as the organ player, which is pretty funny.
Well, I guess this is my opportunity to confess that I'm not a big fan of David Clayton Thomas, so I was wondering what your reaction was to his singing.
Well, I thought that he was he had a great instrument. He had a really good voice, but I didn't believe a word he sang.
Very show.
Yeah, I mean, just to my taste, I didn't think he was a bad singer at all. In fact, he was a much better singer than I was. There was no doubt about that. But like I said, I had that credibility problem with. I mean, I don't consider myself a great singer, but I do believe everything that I sing. I wouldn't sing anything I didn't believe. That's why, you know, I try to write my own material, because then I'm really expressing, the, you know, the true way that I think, although I find other people's songs that I can sing and feel, you know, that I can represent what they're saying. I didn't believe David Clayton Thomas, but again, same thing as this Diamond Ring. You know, what do I know? They became huge.
Right.
They had number one record and had Grammys and...
Yes, exactly, and I can't help but wonder how you felt after leaving the band to watch the band become this huge success.
Well, to tell you the truth, most of that album, the second album, were songs that I had picked for the band and done the arrangements for, and so I felt a part of it. I sort of felt vindicated. I said, "Yeah, you know, this is this idea that I had, and people seem to actually like it, and it's taken a funny turn here because I'm not in it." And then I thought, "Well, this is great. I don't have to go all over the world and play in all these places and everything, and I still get the same satisfaction knowing that this idea that I had worked," which is sort of the way I thought back then. And that was great, except that I never got any financial remuneration for it.
Right. I want to jump ahead to the present. You said that you now think of yourself as 90% talent and 10% ambition, which is the opposite of what you were when you were starting out. What are the projects that you are involved with now or have been involved with lately that have given you the greatest pleasure?
Well, the greatest pleasure in my life is I teach now at the Berklee College of Music in Boston. And I moved there, in fact, specifically to do that. And teaching my classes is sort of the high point of my life right now. Something I really enjoy doing.
What do you like about teaching?
I feel, A, I'm giving something back, and B, I'm dealing with a room full of people who really don't know the things that I'm teaching them, and that they will benefit, I think, tremendously by having that knowledge in their arsenal when they go out into the world.
They probably also don't know your records, at least not at first.
No, they have no idea who I am.
Right, so how does that make you feel?
Good. I mean, I wouldn't expect that they would. I mean, their parents certainly know who I am.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no way they would know who I am, because they're like 17 to 21 years old. And so, you know, I know that going in.
And what have you been doing musically? Are you still writing songs?
I'm still writing songs. I have a studio in my house, and I write the song, and then I go down to the basement and record it, and it gets released in my living room. And that's about it.
Yeah, it's not the surest way to climb the charts.
Well, I'm a legend in my own home and a rumor in my own house.
Well, are you anxious to record or have other people record the new songs that you're writing?
Oh, sure. Everyone's always anxious to do that. The problem is that in the music business, you get sort of a certain window of opportunity. And when that window closes, if you don't respect that, then you could, you know, hang yourself, jump out a window, take an overdose of pills. It's very frustrating, because here you think this is going to last your whole life, and you really have to, you know, take stock of the situation and be prepared for that eventuality when that window shuts, because it always shuts when you don't want it to shut, and it always kind of slams on your fingers, and it's a difficult time. But I always knew that it was coming, and I like kind of waited for it, like stepped outside myself and said, "Is this it? is this it yet? Oh, could this be it? And so I was always ready for that. And in fact, I just put like a storage pile of things that I wanted to do after that so that I wouldn't find myself, you know, hanging myself or jumping out a window or anything.
Teaching was one of those things?
Yeah. Yeah. And I would like to also have a disc jockey show and play old rhythm and blues records and sort of educate people the way I do in school. And write books. Like now I have, you know, my book is out now and I'm excited about that and probably would want to, you know, do more stuff like that. I write a column for a magazine every month and I really enjoy that. And, you know, a chance to do all these things I didn't have time to do before because I was so caught up in the music business.
You know, you write in your book that aging in pop business is always held against you, that, you know, if you're older, you're seen as not being cutting edge anymore and, you know, therefore washed up.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty accurate portrayal of the music business.
Mm-hmm.
Except maybe, you know, in the blues area where they respect seniority.
That's true. That is really true, yeah. It's true in some rock and roll, too, like, you know, I mean, the Rolling Stones can get as old as whatever.
Oh, yeah. No, there are exceptions to the rule, and there are people that are really fortunate enough to keep going, but there are many that don't. And the other thing is that, you know, take a person like Bob Dylan or Sly and the Family Stone. These are people that made incredible music, and yet the society is geared up and insists that they must continue doing that for the rest of their lives or they're horrible people or they're washed up, they're through. But I mean, if you look at the body of work that Sly and the Family Stone left us, it doesn't matter if he writes another song again. He changed music forever and was an incredibly strong influence on the way music is being played today in the R&B field. Everyone owes a debt to him. And yet, you know, people go, he's through, he's a drug hazard. He is none of those things. He is a strong influence in the history of music.
A very good point. Al Cooper, I really appreciate your talking with us, and I want to thank you very much.
It was my pleasure.
Al Cooper, his memoir is called Backstage Passes and Backstabbing Bastards.
I spend the night in a chair thinking she'll be there, but she never comes. And I wake up and wipe the sleep from my eyes, and I rise to spend another day without her. It's just no good anymore when you walk through the door of an empty room. You go inside and set a table for one. It's no fun when you have to spend the day without her. We burst a pretty balloon, took us to the moon. Such a beautiful thing, but it's ended now, and it sounds like a lie. I said I'd rather die than be without her.
Coming up, Daniel Drennan's New York Diaries. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
New Jersey isn't very far from New York City, but it can be a vast distance in terms of lifestyle. It was for Daniel Drennan, who grew up in what he describes as a Levitt-created exurbia, a decidedly middle-class prefab insta-town in the middle of New Jersey. After college and 3 years of study in France, he moved to New York, where the art, theater, concerts, and eccentrics were. His new humorous book is called New York Diaries, Two True Tales of Urban Trauma. Drennan has contributed to the public radio program This American Life and has a following for his satirical Beverly Hills 90210 website. Here's a reading from his New York Diaries.
I was doing my freelance work, eyes behavingly glued to my computer screen, and I hear this loud booming noise like bombs falling. And despite my promise to myself and to the boyfriend that I will not waste my time getting upset at events happening outside my window and outside my control, the temptation proves too great, and I pull back the curtain and notice that a resident in the halfway house / SRO across the street is lobbing things out of his window. Bookshelves, a bike, cast iron skillets, huge objects that I can't imagine fitting through his window in the first place, are now tumbling down 11th Plague style onto the cars and stoop below. Unlike everyone who appears in those live-the-death television shows that appallingly recreate emergency experiences, starring the selfsame people who already suffered through them once, and who now relive for television the one time they called 911 in their lives, I somehow manage to call 911 at least once every other month. And also unlike those scary television shows featuring concerned, caring, heroic 911 telephone operators, I always manage to get New York 911 operators who could not possibly be more blasé asking, "Where's the emergency?" as I give the coordinates of the crime scene, and then, "What's the emergency?" implying that it better be a good one. "Yeah, there's this guy, like, throwing things out his window," I say, trying to portray the seriousness of what is going on with my voice, but failing miserably. The operator pauses and then replies as if disappointed, or rolling her eyes even, "That's the emergency?" as if I am wasting her time. "No, like, really big stuff is coming out of his window. Chairs and bikes and iron skillets and bookcases are coming out of his window," I say, leaning on my window ledge and not getting a thing done as I proudly observe the closed-down street scene of my own creation for the next 3 hours.
So the police finally came?
Yes, they did. And turned it into a block party of sorts.
Yeah, it did. Describe the scene that happened after they did come.
The street was closed down, and of course, the minute you close down a New York City street, the street fills up with people. You know, the police are there to keep it closed and keep people away, but there was a bit of damage done by the things falling outside of this guy's window.
Now, is this what you imagined or what you hoped for when you moved to Manhattan from New Jersey?
I think I had an idea of what New York had to offer. I grew up listening to stories of my father, who was born and raised in Manhattan. And so I kind of grew up with this notion of New York City, of being this place where anything could and sometimes does happen, which left me, when this kind of thing eventually did happen, not surprised, but kind of taken aback at the same time.
What were some of the differences between New York and suburban New Jersey when you were growing up?
Well, growing up, my friends and I would always look at New York as being this place where you could go and be yourself, dress like you want. All of our notions of art and theater and thrift store shopping and all of those kind of things were all in New York City, to my father's great chagrin, I think, that he took the family out to New Jersey for our own well-being, perhaps. And we ended up my friends and I wanted to head right back into the city for fun and all of that stuff.
So you could dress like you wanted in New York. And what was that? What would you wear when you'd go to the city?
Oh, all of those phases that you go through as a teenager, including dyed hair, pierced ears, what else? The black clothes, the skinny ties, all of those things during the 70s and 80s that defined a certain sense of rebellion, as much as you could rebel in a suburban environment.
And now that you actually live in New York, do you look down on the teenagers who come through the bridges and tunnels in their defiant clothing?
Not really, although I have to say it does give me pause at times to see the kids dressed up as punks and all of that, which I remember having gone through 20-some years ago, and it seemed like an endless cycle of rebellion that we never seemed to get past.
You know, you write in your book, The New York Diaries, that you're so at home in New York because you have so many neuroses. It's the only place on earth where you feel you actually fit in. You have a very funny description of when you took your dog to the vet, and the vet basically said, what did the vet tell you?
The vet, my dog had been sick for a while, not being able to eat, and walking around with his, or sitting with his back arched up in the air. And the vet's question to me, instead of diagnosing the dog, was whether I was under a lot of stress or not. And I didn't quite know how to respond to her because I didn't know where she was going with the question. But she cleared it up for me when she told me that she thought my dog was picking up on my stress and was manifesting an ulcer or pre-ulcerous condition, which we had to treat with Tagamet and other anti-acids and things of that nature, which to me, I felt like, well, you know, maybe we should just give the pills directly to me and, you know, solve the problem at the source instead of the symptoms at the dog level. But I was quite taken aback by that.
Do you ever ask yourself if the rats and the mice and the roaches and the crack dealers and the muggers are worth it living in New York?
I ask myself that all the time, and I've often left the city in hopes of finding something in my mind that would be better. For a while, I thought I was going to end up in San Francisco working, and I can remember going out there and thinking, this is it. This is where I'm going to be, and sending postcards to everyone, telling them to just send my stuff over because I had found where I wanted to stay. But something always calls me back and brings me back to the city. It's perhaps a sense of just being able to be yourself and not having to worry about that and the facades that we often put up to hide our true selves seem to be, for better and worse, missing in New York City.
On the other hand, it's the place where people cover up who they are with fashion and
that's true.
And attitude
that's true.
And all of this.
Right.
I mean, and people wear more body armor in New York than probably any place else in the world.
This
character
is true.
Armor is what I mean. Character
right,
armor.
Right.
So you need the body armor, too. So what brought
this
you back
true.
From San Francisco?
I think the sheer niceness of people in San Francisco put me off on some level. And I don't mean that in a bad way. It was more, I love the honesty of New Yorkers, and there's something refreshing about people who will tell you their opinion whether you ask for it or not, I think.
Daniel Drennan is the author of New York Diaries. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today was Roberta Sharrock. Chris Fraley was our engineer. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Little Brown and Company, publisher of Holiday on Ice by NPR commentator David Sedaris, available in paperback in bookstores nationwide. This is NPR, National Public Radio.